Accession number 11939, rule 5.
Mr. John Williams, Reel 5. What was the actual process of mobilization on the 1st of September, Mr. Williams?
Well, we had been round, and we'd been several people, and of course the 1st of September was a Friday, and the Thursday prior to that, that would be the 31st of August, was a drill night. And practically the whole of the people turned up who weren't actually away. Some were living in London, as a matter of fact. And the word was just, everybody was to be ready. Now, to be quite honest, we didn't pass out any information to the people about the mobilisation. I just remember entirely, whether we warned them on the Thursday to wait for any news on the radio or anything of that nature, I can't quite remember. But they all assembled. Our part in after that was comparatively simple. They all assembled at the drill hall.
This was in Chopwell.
In Chopwell Drill Hall on the 1st of September in the afternoon and evening, and drew their weapons, which were considered rifles and bayonets and Bren guns and equipment. They had their kit bags, and then buses took us away on the Friday evening to a drill hall in South Shields. At Chopwell, we had no catering for food or anything of that nature. We just went down there, and it was obvious to me when we arrived there that headquarters, Gates at headquarters, had organised a sort of administration side, because we just simply went there and drew blankets and went into this drill hall.
What equipment had you been issued with, Mr. Williams?
Well, we'd been issued with our arms, but when we got to our first war station, as it was called, at South Shields, we got our respirators. Another interesting fact is that at that time, there was no such thing as battle dress for us. We were still wearing the ordinary service dress with bright buttons and with our shoulder tags which had T for Territorial Army. And there was a great point made that as we were now, as we thought to ourselves, in the regular army, we removed the T from our epaulettes and simply had the DLI badge. Just as though we were regular soldiers. We rather fancied ourselves at that point, but we had took the teeth out because we were no longer territorials. We were regular soldiers, we said. And that was about it. And we still had the pick caps, and we still were wearing putties with our eight wraps and boots, and we're still wearing, and had to polish our buttons every morning and that sort of thing, you see. We hadn't attained to the happy state of a battle dress at that stage.
There was nothing on the equipment side that you were short of?
No, well, we were so simply charged in those days. We had, in those happy days or unhappy days, we had our four sections, with two were rifle sections and two were Bren gun sections. Headquarters had 2 3-inch mortars. Later on, that was 6. We had no Vickers machine guns. And that was it. We were very simply armed. Just, in fact, I'm surprised they didn't have us spitting bullets into the and ramrod into our rifle, you know what I mean? We were so, and we didn't have any ammunition at that stage.
Do I take it from that description that in effect you weren't particularly well trained for war?
We were not, there's no doubt about it. It was a bit of fun at that stage, and although we had the undoubted advantage of being a unit where we knew each other and a unit which accepted discipline as far as we knew it, I think we might have all died should the Germans launch an attack at that stage. We might have made an effort, but we would have probably died. But we would have died side by side because we were disciplined, which I think was an important thing. We had a standard, and we were, shall I say, disciplined, but woefully trained. And at that stage, woefully unfit.
What was the mood of the rest of the men?
Well, there was a certain amount of excitement and interest. After all, we were normally young fellows. There was one sergeant I remember particularly who was a little bit distraught because he didn't want to leave his wife. There was also one man who'd been a young soldier in the 1418 war, in the 1918, and he was a little bit solemn. There were also one or two men, older men, let me say, who suddenly discovered that they felt there was something wrong with them. It was very obvious that they were looking for out. But apart from that, the majority of people, it was just a joke. Everybody joking and think we felt very important, you know. And we snapped into disciplines on. People took orders very well. The night after the war was declared, just to give you an idea, they were allowed to go out for a drink. Some got drunk and they were put in the guard room. Without much trouble. There was one drunken character who wouldn't go into the guard room for a sergeant whom he didn't like. So he turned around and said, "I'll gun into the guard room for Sergeant Williams, but I'll not gun in for you." So I went across him and said, "Come on, lad, in the guard room." And he went in. It's sort of silly, sort of playing at soldiers, really.
And was there any fear that, from the experience of the First World War, of mass charges and heavy casualties?
No. We didn't think about that, and I never heard that mentioned. Except one of these old soldiers, as I said, or subsequently didn't go to France with us because he was getting on, but who was, said he hoped it wasn't as bad as the last one, you know. But we weren't taking any notice of him. I think we were betraying the proverbial sort of soldier going to war. And it would take a little bit of bloodletting to make us realise it was serious, you know. And all the stories of the... In fact, a lot of us didn't realise the slaughter of the 1418 war. We'd been children when it went on, some weren't even born. And I think it was a habit for 1418 war men not to talk too much. They'd had such a bellyful of horrid conditions. They didn't talk an awful lot. And so we weren't very much informed. In our drill hall, there was a fellow who used to come on a Sunday, going just before the war. He used to come every Sunday and get a fair good skinful of beer. Now, his name was Young, and he was awarded the VC in the 9th Battalion in the 1418 war. And all the time he was in for a drink, I never heard him mention the VC or the Army or anything. He was so interested in downing pints of bitter beer, but he never mentioned it at all. And when I look back now, I feel very sad. I never had an opportunity of talking to a VC at that early stage, you know. But that was just the way it was in those days.
What about your family, your parents? Obviously, they would have memories of the First World War. Did they see this war that you were going
to? My mother and father were very worried. They were on holiday at Tynemouth, and I sent them a telegram just saying, called up. And they came back home, because they were a bit upset about the war, you know. And it was only then my father told me, he said, when you were a very small boy in 1914, you were not quite 2 years old by then, about a year and a half, and we were on holiday at Tynemouth then, and the soldiers were called up and they were at the plaza at Tynemouth. And as you were running along the road, there was a sergeant said, "There's a pair of good little legs, we'll have him in the army." And my father said, in a rather shaken voice, "I never thought you'd be in the army."
When you were received at South Shields, was there any marked difference between the kind of reception you'd had prior to this event in the past and into this one? Was the discipline suddenly marked? Was there a change of any way?
The discipline was immediate. There was a sort of acceptance of discipline, which was rather good because it showed that we were a united unit. Well, Martin had known what to do. I think if it had come to the worst, we would have probably formed squares like they did about 1760 and died quite happily that we were with a good regiment, you know. But it was, except there was a strong acceptance of discipline. And there was a standing to attention to corporals and sergeants, which had never occurred before, you know. It should have occurred, you understand, but it was just a sudden acceptance of discipline and so on. And the other thing, of course, was that all we sergeants started growing a moustache because we thought we looked rather young. And sergeants in film and fiction and in books and always had big moustaches. So we decided we'd all grow a moustache, all we sergeants. I was 26, some were 25, some 28 and so on. And we just did that. Another sign of acceptance of military tradition, you know.
What were your duties at South Shields?
Well, I was a platoon sergeant, but I also found myself... It's the old, old story. I was slightly unique in our company because I was a clerk. All the rest were miners and labourers and people like that. And so I found myself getting odd clerical duties. And somebody would say, will you ring up headquarters and say so-and-so, on the assumption that I would put the message into acceptable English, that sort of thing, you know. And I counted things, you know, and issued things and that sort of thing. And we had our respirators then, and we'd all been shown rather roughly how to put them on. And, of course, to move on a couple of days later, immediately war was declared, the sirens went. And we got everybody to put the respirators on, fumbling on with them, you know. And then we suddenly realised there was a war on, but, I mean, just temporary, you know.
Which company were you in?
A Company.
Of the 9th Battalion?
Of the 9th Battalion, yes.
And the platoon?
Well, I forget which platoon I was. Oh, I'm sorry. Our quartermaster was working in London. Colour sergeant, that is. And until he arrived 2 days later, I acted as quartermaster, seeing about rations and ammunition and respirators and things like that. And then I handed over to him. And I was in a rifle platoon. I forget which one it was. But not a Ren gun platoon, a rifle platoon, you know. And then later on, of course, we moved down to Gloucestershire.
Outside of the extraneous duties that you were given, what had your duties and responsibilities with the rifle platoon changed in any way?
No. Because I had done a certain amount of, you know, training with the rifle, bit of bayonet drill, you know, literally we sort of in, out, on guard sort of thing, you know. And it didn't change very much. We didn't assume any new sort of situation or new drill. We were just there. We, strange enough, not for motives of, what shall I say, the extra duty of polishing our buttons and so on, but we'd seen pictures and so on of the army in battle dress. And we rather thought that we were a little bit archaic until we got battle dress. We didn't get them until November, incidentally. But we rather thought that we were a little bit archaic. But we had to polish our buttons and be very smart. And have eight laps in our putties and so on. Everything had to be smartened up.
Who was your platoon commander?
Well, first of all, our company commander was Captain Jackson, who was the solicitor from Consett. And then we got a gentleman called Henderson, a lieutenant, or second lieutenant, Henderson, who was my platoon commander. He was a gentleman who spent some time in jail later. He wasn't much of an officer, and he was a little bit of a Flash Harry, if I may excuse the expression. But he was one of these... it was the people who were attracted to a sort of commission. They thought wouldn't have so much work to do, and...
In what ways did he show himself to be a bad officer?
A too familiar attitude. Not friendly, familiar with the men, you know. And also at times he would sort of say, oh, well, it's just what you expect from the bloody army, isn't it? Whereas if we'd been told to stand on our head as an officer, he should have supported that principle, you know. But there's a difference between friendliness and familiarity. The other officers were friendly, but were not familiar. It's a difficult sort of nuance, I agree, but, you know, you could... they might be friendly in some, but you still... We had to call him sir, but he used to be very, very sort of... And hands in pockets and that sort of thing, you know.
How did he finish in jail?
Well, it was after the war. Just after the war, he got mixed up in some sort of fiddle, but he wasn't an officer who was very reliable. I think he got an adverse report. You know, as an officer, you were reported on every year. And you had to sign. If you got your report was good or it was adverse, and you had to sign it, so you would get an adverse report, not the type.
Well, your recollections of the other officers in the battalion at this time?
Yes. In the main, very good, but in those days, very conscious that they were of a superior race. You know, an almost feudal attitude, you know.
Do you recall your battalion commander?
Yes. He was a very nice bloke. I forget his name now. It'll come back to me. If you hadn't asked me, I'd have told you. But he was quite a nice bloke. He was an ex-1418 war. And I got to know him very well later, because I was detached under his command for a short while when the balloon went up.
Was this one of the Simpsons?
Simpson, yes, right. Colonel Simpson, that was it. And they were still Territorial Army commanders. At a later stage, practically after the first campaign in France, there was a mass removal of territorial colonels and a replacement by regulars. And I think that was perhaps due, in many cases, not in all cases, that was due to the fact that it was a social job, a colonel in Territorial Army. He was liable to be hobnobbing with the upper crust, the Lord Barnards and the people of our local establishment. And they weren't necessarily good soldiers. I don't mean they were bad men. They weren't good tacticians and that sort of thing. And of course, it was from 1918 to 1939, it was 21 years. And there were men who had grown rather grey as colonels who'd never... There'd been perhaps young soldiers or young officers in the 1418 war, some of them very brave and decorated, but it was an awful long time. And then there'd been junior officers. And here they were, suddenly found themselves as colonels. And
how old would Simpson be?
Well, I always reckoned that he must have been somewhere about mid-40s, you know. And most of the officers, 6th, 8th and 9th commanding officers, would be in that sort of group, you know. They were all wearing First World War ribbons, but as I say, they'd been platoon commanders at the very most in the First World War, and here suddenly they were in charge of 800, 900 men.
Do you recall any of the names of the other officers?
Yes, well, there was Major Scott. He was with the Bladen Company, John Scott. He was with... And there was... our transport officer was Captain Sell, who later is now Colonel Sell, you know. Then there was a man who subsequently became our company commander before we went to France, George Leslie Wood, Captain Wood, who subsequently became Colonel of the 6th. And his brother, he had a brother, Ken Wood, who was a captain, you know. And they were nice blokes, but we, like us, they were all lacking in military experience. And it was rather strange. I was most surprised, I'm digressing here slightly, when Colonel Wood became a decorated colonel. Because as a captain, he was a very gentle sort of character, and he used to ask me for advice about things, you know, about what did I think about this man, what would I do in such and such a case and so on. And at that stage, I thought he was a very amiable company commander, respected, friendly, but not familiar. But I never envisaged for one moment that he would be a lieutenant colonel with a DSOMC, you know. So it was a case of developing when the situation warranted, you know.
What are your memories of the other NCOs in the battalion? Were they of a good quality?
The NCOs, of course, there were a lot of, there were regular people. Our regimental sergeant major was Regimental Sergeant Major Biff Wilson. And he was what... Everybody admitted he was a bit of a bugger in discipline and training and smartness and so on. And then our company sergeant major was a territorial. There were company sergeant majors in the other battalions, in the other companies in the battalion, who were also territorial. But Biff Wilson, as we called him, Regimental Sergeant Major Wilson, was the key man there. And he ruled us with a rod of iron, which was a good thing, really, you know. And... But in the main, the sergeants and warrant officers and colour sergeants were bugle major, all just very decent blokes. And then the bugle major, subsequently during the war, he was commissioned and when I was in the territorial after the war, he came into the drill hall and he betrayed his origins by walking into our mess without invitation in the parachute regiment mess and saying he'd been in the battalion before and he just called in for a drink. Smart enough bloke, but...
Did you call his name?
McCluskey. I couldn't... it sounds terribly snobbish to talk like that, you know, but I early decided that you had to be friendly, but when you shouted, and it happened more so in battle, and if you were a person in charge, a sergeant, corporal, sergeant, people had to look at you and wait for instructions. You didn't have to say, hey, Jack, would you mind doing this, or something of that nature, you know? You had to shout at them, and they had to stiffen up and do what they were told. And we sort of, again, we accepted that. I think that was one of the virtues of the Territorial Army. We might have not been right up to mark in modern tactics and weapons, because 2 hours a week in a fortnight at camp didn't give you much chance. But the fact is that we felt we were a unit. And even today, when I go down to those old comrades, you know, once a month we go down to the British Legion Club, Gateshead. And there's a warm feeling, you know. I might have been a major, and John Scott might have been a major, but one or two lads say, "Who are you gunning on?" You know, and your mind's so-and-so, and immediately your mind goes back, you know. And I think the value of comradeship, it sounds awfully trite to talk like that now, but there was a comradeship which stood us in good stead, you know.
When you got to South Shields, you said that you'd drawn blank. What were you sleeping on?
Just on the floor in the drill hall.
And did this continue for long?
No, after a while, we got palliasses with straw, you know. Just only palliasses. But I don't recollect sleeping on a bed for ages, you know, on a bunk even, you know. That, I'm telling you a lie, early in October, I went down to the gas school at Fort Tregantle. I was sent down on a corsair, and then I was in a proper barrack with a bunk and everything. I thought, smashing this, why didn't I join the army?
What was the food situation like in South Shields in those early days?
Very good. It wasn't army rations. It was first-class food, civilian food, very much like we were at camp, only it seemed if anything seemed to be improvised in our favour, you know.
Was this cooked by civilian cooks?
No, it was we had the cooks. And we had company cooks, and a lot of stuff would be brought sort of half cooked up, I suppose, from battalion and cooked up. There was no worry about salmonella and things in those days, you know. I didn't know it existed. And we all had hearty after that. And the thing was, of course, don't forget, men drawn from all walks of life, miners and so on, suddenly found themselves 24 hours a day in fresh air and so on. It was quite good.
What kind of duties did you carry out in South Shields while you were there? How long were you there?
I can't. We weren't there very long. I can't remember precisely. But we had drilling in the drill hall square, you know. We had a church parade. And I remember it was there that I, after being cursed and sworn at while I went to go on church parade, I suddenly decided that it was a strange sort of thing to be effed and blinded on a square and then marched into the house of God. So I changed my religion from primitive Methodist to agnostic. And the next, we must have been there 2 Sundays, because the next Sunday I told Captain Jackson, who was still our company commander, that I would fall in and march up to the church door, but I'd turn right at the church door and fall out, as I was not attending church anymore. And he said, "Sergeant Major, find the sergeant some fatigue to do." So I said to him, "Could I have an interview with the CO, Colonel, sir?" And he said, "What for?" I said, "It says in regimental standing orders that no man shall be punished for his conscientious beliefs. And I believe that in you saying, find this sergeant fatigue, that you're attempting to punish me for my religious beliefs." And he said, We've got a barrack room lawyer, have we, Sergeant Williams? I said, no, sir, but you've got a sergeant who knows his rights as well as his responsibilities. So he just burst out laughing, and that was the finish.
Were you guarding any key points?
No. It was, I think it was just an assembly point, really. We weren't doing any guarding in that sense. We were just in the drill hall, and we were guarding our own. We had sentries, and we had a guard on every night and so on, and it was mounted in the usual fashion, but we weren't guarding any, and we weren't conscious of any threat, because there weren't any Germans, right? You understand? Whether it had been IRA or any other sort of people in those days, I don't know, but we certainly just carried out garrison duty, you know.
Where did you go to from South Shields?
We went down to Morton in the Marsh.
Did you recall
sorry, the Shipston-on-Stour. I do apologise, Shipston-on-Stour.
Do you recall what date this would be?
This must have been in September. And we were spread over there. There was Shipston-on-Stour and Morton in the Marsh. All those places in Gloucester with all, you know, Boughton on the Water, that sort of thing. And it was from there I went on a course down at Fort Tregantle, down near Plymouth. Gas Corps, Army Gas Corps.
Before we go on to that, Mr. Williams, the 50th Division was a motorised division. Had you been introduced to any motorised train?
No. But not at that stage. It was only when we got down to Gloucester that I suddenly realised that we had the, I think it was the 4th Battalion of Northumberland Fusiliers who were motorised. And we were used eventually of leaping onto three tonners and jumping off from the backboard and that sort of thing. And that was the limit of our motorisation, you know.
How had you moved from the North East down to Gloucestershire?
I think we went by train. And that's right, we went down by train. And we were billeted in the town there.
And how were you received?
Very well by the people. Too well in some cases. We got our first cases of VD down there in Shipston-on-Stour. So although it was very close to, comparatively close to Shakespeare's birthplace in those areas, must have inherited some of his characters.
So you said that when you got there, you ultimately became or gained experience of motorised.
Yes.
Formations.
Yes.
Where were the army lorries or were the
army lorries? No, there were army lorries, and we used to get on them. You know, it was speed in getting on a lorry and getting off. That was the extent of motorisation. So it could be moved. I mean, and we had a sort of a reconnaissance section which comprised of Northumberland Fusiliers on motorbikes and sidecars. With a machine gun, with a Bren gun on in the sidecar, you know. Hitler must have roared his head off, you know, and he's, no doubt his agents reported when you think of all the 2,500 tanks he had ready for us, you know. But that was what mattered. Again, it served to make us more alert, and we knew we had to be moved quickly, and we knew we had to move quickly when we got other trucks and that sort of thing, you know. But it was a very, very skeleton sort of training. And apart from that, we did a lot of marches.
This would be cross-country?
Roads and cross-country and that sort of thing. But to get us to build a march, you know, we'd get up to about 20 miles and that sort of thing, you know. And we just marched along there. And
how did the locals feel with you marching here, there and everywhere across their countryside?
They didn't seem to object at all. I think they accepted the fact that they had to have soldiers and now there was a war on. And they were very friendly, and you know, you went into the pubs and so on. And they were. Strange thing was, thing I couldn't remember then, there was a tremendous increase in dart playing. They seemed to play darts more in these Gloucester pubs than they did up in the northeast here. I suppose up here at that time they were so busy drinking beer they didn't have much time for darts. But every pub had its dart board, you know, and there were real competition and so on.
What were your billets like?
Quite good. I think we were living in an old shop, you know, but we were still just on blankets and palliasses, you know, and I was surprised in a way the number of empty houses and empty places for billeting, you know. I don't think we could have turned anybody out, but there must have been some shops that were due for selling that weren't sold and that sort of thing, you know.
Was the food situation still good?
Still good, army rations, yes, first class, yes. Not the standard that we had later in the war, you understand, because it was all been, there was an awful lot of stews and that sort of thing, because they were cooking them up in Dixies and that sort of thing. But perfect, perfectly good food. And of course, with an outdoor life and plenty of exercise, we'd have eaten the table here as it cut up in the sections, you know.
And the training that was going on there, what form did it take?
It was, the training was, we marched, we deployed, open order, cross country, you know. In fact, it would almost amount to what Sir John Moore taught his soldiers in 1805 or something, you know, open order march. And then we at one stage, it's about fixed bayonets and then get up and charge about 30 or 40 yards. But that was just maybe charging a ditch or something like that, you know. But
So he still felt that it had any effect on the First World War?
Still, oh, yes, absolutely, yes, yes.